The tank is open, which means it's time for another edition of the Shark Tank Recap here on Reality TV Wrap-Ups. Hello, everyone. Mike Bloom here, but it's no shock that I am not alone. I am joined, as always, by Jasmeet Sidhu. Jasmeet, welcome back.
It's good to be back. Hello, everybody.
All right, so we're here to talk about the Season 7 finale of Shark Tank, as well as the Season 2 finale and possibly series finale of Beyond the Tank. So a lot of closure being done in quite an energetic episode. I would say an electrifying episode, if that.
I think they definitely ended on an energetic note, to say the least. If not, maybe a kind of a negative note, but we can get into that.
We'll definitely get into that, because I think, you know, this Shark Tank episode really ran the gamut in terms of there were just a bunch of pitches coming from a bunch of different industries, getting a lot of different receptions. Obviously, some of them walked out with deals, some of them didn't. That's the nexus of the show. But that being said, I do agree. You know, if they did just come in with a big slew of pitches and just try to strategically place things in specific episodes, I feel like they really closed out with four very, very interesting pitches.
Yep. And, you know, the editors obviously knew that the pitches they were putting in this episode were going to be in the season finale. So it's interesting to look at it from that perspective of particularly the last pitch, which I'm sure we'll talk about a lot about why they kind of chose that as the one to finish off the season and what kind of tone I think they set for the Shark Tank.
Definitely. I mean, the voiceover guy in the beginning of this episode calls this, you know, the Shark Tank is bloodier than ever this episode. And I feel like that really does hold not only in the last segment, but, you know, in other segments, you have sharks kind of snapping at each other more than they usually were. Maybe they were doing this at the tail end of their schedules and everyone was just a little like hangry. They didn't have their PMS bites, so they were, you know, expressing irritability.
This is the hangry episode of the Shark Tank.
It might be, you know, these sharks were looking for blood and then they sniffed some in the water this time. But I don't want to get too far down this rabbit hole at first, because we have our own little update here, our own little segments in lieu of one not really happening in this episode. So back when we did our notable pitches and Beyond the Tank bonus podcast a few weeks ago, we talked about Steve Gatlin's I Want to Draw a Cat for You. And as part of my shark accountability promise, I said I would purchase a picture from the website. Well, this past week, if you do not follow any of us on Twitter or if you aren't part of the RHAP patron group, we did get that photo back. So, all right.
Yeah, so, where do we start about this photo?
Well, so Steve Gatlin, he says that, you know, the whole genesis of this project is, I don't know who you are. You know, you can pay an extra amount to have a cat to get like specifics about what you want to be drawn. But usually he's just going to like see your name. Something will come to mind and then he'll draw it out. So I went with that option, the cheapest option, but I don't know. I feel like this drawing might be almost a little too convenient and ironic to have that be the case, because basically our drawing, which is, by the way, number 19,840. So he really has done a bunch since appearing in season 2 of Shark Tank, consists of a bearded cat with two buck teeth, wearing what looks like a tiny leprechaun hat. He has rather short arms and he's rather large around the middle with shorts.
Rotund is what I
rather
like to
rotund
say.
Yes. He should definitely, you know, be sticking to the vegan meals from now on. But he just says one short exclamation, which is poop. So I don't know if this cat is a squatty potty fan, but I'm going to put on the tinfoil hat here a little bit, Jasmine. Do you think there's a chance Steve Gatlin had heard our take on his product on this podcast and in response, quote unquote, randomly decided to put a cat that says poop to send to us?
I don't know. That might be going too far down the rabbit hole. Do you think he actually listened to our podcast? Like, were we overly negative? I don't remember being overly critical about the product.
I don't think so either, but you never know. You know, I come from the Top Chef podcast where, you know, random chef testants would listen to things and also then, you know, try to negatively reach out to us on Twitter, and sometimes they misappropriate things that certain one of us have said about other contestants, but I won't go to that rabbit hole.
Right. We do get a few of like the product's Twitter accounts favoriting a couple of our tweets or like following us. I don't know if they're actually listening to the podcast or they're just doing the social media thing where they just favorite any mention of theirs, but
that's true. I mean, I did tweet out again this picture that we got from I Want to Draw a Cat for You. I noticed Steve Gatlin did favorite the tweet, but I don't know if that means that he was following our journey or if he just like has an SEO or a Google alert search for you mentioning I want to draw a cat for you.
I have an idea. We should try to reach out to him to see if he'll come on our podcast and explain this picture to us.
Well, and also he's also going out of business, so he's going to have a lot of free time. So maybe we'll be able to grab him as a bonus podcast in the off season.
Right. But you know, it's a cute picture. If you haven't seen it, I can retweet it out again after this podcast, but it's cute. I wasn't overly offended by it.
No, I just think it's funny that, you know, after in direct, it might be a direct response. It might just be a cat saying poop. Either way, I enjoyed it. Let's go to the other half of our shark accountability formula thus far. Jasmine, any updates on Kid Runner?
No. I'm still signed up to their newsletter. I have not received any email alerts that this thing is out on the market yet. So still crossing my fingers. Maybe it'll come out this summer.
Well, let's remember that was the big thing, right? Is that they said, well, we haven't actually done anything yet. So it seems like that status is still up no matter when they filmed on Shark Tank.
Right. So he's still doing his research. He's still modifying the product. So we'll see if it ever comes out.
All right, so let's dive into the episode proper here. Let's start with our first segment. Speaking of a blast from the past here, it's very rare that we see someone come back into the tank, let alone someone who comes back into the tank for a completely different product. But here we are, Erin Marino for Pete and Pedro.
Yep. So, you know, I think you mentioned a statistic a couple podcasts ago about how, you know, it's so hard to even get casted on the show. I think of all the people that must apply, only a very small percentage actually make it.
I saw 2% or something like that.
Yeah.
I might just be looking at a milk carton, but 2%
well,
comes
we'll
to
go with 2% unless someone can find or correct us. So 2% of people who apply make it onto the show. So that being said, it's more extremely rare for someone who's already been on the show to return. I'm thinking it's only happened twice before. There was a man with the wine, portable wine cups. And I want to say there was a woman. I can't remember the product, but I feel like this has only happened two or three times before. So we have Erin Marino. I don't remember this pitch exactly when it aired. It looked vaguely familiar. He came in with an Alpha M system, which was essentially style DVDs for men, which he was hawking for about $250. I don't know anybody who would buy a DVD for $250.
Well, apparently we're going to know one person.
One person did.
So yeah, I ended up watching this pitch because I didn't remember it either, but I watched the season 4 episode Erin was on before coming on here. And yeah, I mean, this was pretty much doomed from inception here. He came in a suit and said, I'm offering basically this DVD series to get people from Joe to pro, essentially. And the reason why Mark yells out A2B2 is not a, you know, very labored Star Wars reference. It's because he had like an alphanumeric system of different clothing items. And so he would say like, okay, so this guy is wearing A2, B3, C4, D11. So, I mean, looking at that pitch, not to speak too much about that, because unlike the sharks, we will focus more on Pete and Pedro rather than Alpha M. But yeah, I would not pay $250 to have a DVD system that essentially says, hey, go out and buy hundreds of dollars or more of clothing items. I just feel like that doesn't make sense. Plus, we'll talk about him being a stylist YouTuber later on, but I feel like you're almost putting a price on something that you usually offer for free otherwise.
Right. So, you know, it was no surprise that he didn't get a deal back then, which was season 4, 3 years ago. And it was no surprise that after the airing of Shark Tank, usually the products do get a bit of a Shark Tank boost. But he was saying that after the airing of the episode, he only sold one DVD.
That's so pathetic.
I mean, one DVD for $250, that's pretty awesome. Whoever that person was, it might even been like his mom or something. Who knows?
Yeah, you have to assume it might have even just been him. Like, oh, well, again, I haven't bought this for myself yet. I might as well do it to boost. You know how like sometimes, like I'll admit, when podcasts like these that I'm on pop up in my feed, I might try to download it at first to kind of boost the numbers a little bit. Maybe Marino was doing it in a very similar style with a $300 price tag onto it.
But is it more embarrassing to say you only sold one or you just didn't sell any? I don't know. I kind of feel like it's more embarrassing to say you've just sold one.
Yeah, I guess so, though. I don't know. Selling none is also pretty pitiful as well. It's really a game of inches.
Right. So here we are. It's 3 years later and Erin Marino comes back and he has a new product. He says he's learned so much from a Shark Tank experience and he's developed, I guess, a hairstyling product called Pete and Pedro, which comes with a little bit of a donkey logo, which gets referenced multiple times during this pitch. And he's asking the sharks for $100,000 for 10%. And he goes into a little bit of the numbers. I believe he was saying that he says that this is a $1 million business, but I think he's like conflating a few of the numbers.
Just a bit. He says he sold $800,000. He's predicting he's going to sell $800,000, which is not a million.
Right. So he says, I think he's averaging $55,000 this month in sales. And then we get a little bit into his YouTube influencing life, for lack of a better word, where he has 600,000 followers, 5.5 million views a month. And essentially, a huge chunk of his revenue is him being endorsed by various products to talk about it on his YouTube channel. And, you know, he's able to get a cut of the products that way. But as we learn, the money that he's asking for in the Shark Tank is not in that part of the deal, the social media business.
Yeah, it looks like he's really trying to keep Alpha M and Pete and Pedro separated here, in that, you know, he tried to link it with his brand last time he was on, but he feels like he learned his lesson. And by learning his lesson, he probably thought, OK, I need to do something completely different. But now the sharks are saying, no, go back to what you have. You know, don't reinvent the wheel here, which I would agree with. So the name Pete and Pedro sounds a little strange. However, I went onto the Pete and Pedro website, and there is the legend of Pete and Pedro. Jasmeet, this is the season finale. Do you want to hear the story of Pete and Pedro?
I think we have to, because I don't even know the story.
Okay, so this is, again, verbatim from the website at PeteandPedro.com. As legend has it, told by my pop, the story of Pete and Pedro is a tale of two best friends, Pete and his loyal donkey Pedro, the donkey with bueno hair. Approximately 100 years ago, there was a boy named Pete. Well, Pete was given two things by his father before his untimely demise in a freak jalapeno harvesting accident: a donkey named Pedro and his father's unmanageable hair. Parentheses, genetics are a bitch sometimes. Now, this is where the story gets a little fuzzy and has caused a few disagreements over the years about what happened next, but essentially it went something like this. Normally, donkeys have short, coarse, bristly manes, but not Pedro. Pedro had a remarkably gorgeous mane that was soft and silky to the touch. It wasn't too dry and it wasn't too oily, but was always perfect. It was so extraordinary that Pete would ride Pedro around town every day, passing the time caressing his marvelous mane. But one day, when Pete was having a particularly bad hair day, he looked to the heavens, clenched his little fists, and yelled at the top of his lungs, "Why is my hair so bad and my donkey Pedro so bueno?" Apparently, Pedro had a little secret to why his mane was so tame, and sensing his friend's frustration, he showed Pete his secret. At first, Pete thought for sure his good buddy was just trying to ease the emotional distress of a lifetime of bad hair tends to cause, but he figured he'd give Pedro's secret a try. Lo and behold, since that day, Pete has maintained bueno hair of his very own.
Wow. I don't even know what to say to that.
This might be the next Pixar movie in the hopper.
Right. Do you think Aaron wrote that himself? He had to have written that himself, right?
I mean, you would have a feeling that, if I'm assuming this is like a Mexican folklore tale, that they wouldn't say, "Oh yes, and Pedro had bueno hair." I feel like that's like the most anglicized take on a Mexican story there is.
Right. Well, can't say this guy doesn't have a lack of creativity, I guess.
Yeah, you know, he's a content creator. He's a YouTuber. I guess he thought like, "Oh yeah, I could definitely brand this." So that's where the logo comes from. And Kevin pokes a lot of fun with it, as you talked about before. He calls it the donkey deal. He calls the company Mini Donkey later on. So, there's jokes to that from the very beginning when they're passing around the hair products and everyone's making the Kevin Bald joke. So, assuming if we're going along Kevin's line here of "I only invest in the products I use," you would assume that he's not going to show much interest in this.
Right. So, you know, we just had it in the last episode saying I'm only going to invest in products I use. He clearly does not need hair products, but he ends up making an offer of $100,000 for 20% of not just Pete and Pedro, but the Alpha M social media business. I think essentially what appeals to him about Aaron is his social media influence network. I think he sees an opportunity there to be able to sell other products that he's invested in on Shark Tank, and he sees someone who has the ability to show those products for him. So that's why he wants both the business, not the hair product itself.
Yeah, and that makes sense. I mean, let's speak to that a little bit. I mean, do you think that Aaron was making a mistake going in here trying to completely separate this from his social media business? He does end up walking out with a deal, and the sharks kind of turn it into their own deal. But do you think he would have done a lot better if he walked in and said, "Hey, I'm a YouTuber. This is something that I want to tie into my own product line"?
I mean, I think so. I mean, they have to have known, or he has to, he must have known, like, when he brought out the numbers of his YouTube following, that, like, you know, this happens a few times in the Shark Tank where it's like, here's something I've done really well, but now I want to do something new. And you're going to be investing in the thing that's new and not the thing that has been done really well. And that has always annoyed the sharks, being like, you know, the new thing doesn't have a record of doing really well. Why are you separating it from the old thing, which is something that can sell? So in his case, the old thing is himself. He's the product. He can sell things. And why are we not getting a piece of that pie? So I can understand that. And I think he should have known that coming in.
Yeah. And we talked about this even a little bit with the inch bug stuff, right? With Mike Drinky, how the Sharks essentially did away with that product and said, okay, no, I want to focus specifically on this other product that's been doing really, really well for you. And it's also interesting. I mean, looking back again at that season 4 pitch, Aaron talks nothing about being a YouTuber. I'm not entirely sure if he was even on YouTube at this point, but I feel like even in just 3 years, the term YouTuber has actually become a legitimate career, so much so that someone would go on to Big Brother Canada, for example, and put it as their career, that it's an actual thing. And I mean, I know many situations where YouTubers do get endorsements and do get monetization from said endorsements. So yeah, go ahead.
I was gonna say, you know, I think 3 years ago, this was 2013, I think honestly in the span of that time, being a YouTuber did become a legitimate career. I think Forbes did some sort of list of like the people who've made the most amount of money from being a YouTube star. And it's a ridiculous amount. We're talking like millions of dollars, depending on how large their following is. So it's no joke. You can actually be a YouTuber as a career if you have built up enough following and are able to like sell products and sell endorsements or get a cut of the advertising revenue from what YouTube runs before your video. So it's a real thing. So, you know, going back to the pitch, Lori just pretty much flat out says, I don't get why this is fantastic. She's out. And we've got Barbara coming in, and she says, you know, I don't think you need any of our help. But what you don't know and what I know is how to build up a business, when to know when to fire people, when to know when to hire people, and build up sort of the business infrastructure. And she makes an offer for $100,000 for 10% for just his Alpha M social media business. So I think she really wants to develop him as a brand and as a company and sort of just ride this YouTube influence to some big bucks.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I mean, maybe someone in the comments can tell us about whether Sharks do have invested in YouTubers in the past couple seasons, because as we just talked about, it really has become a prevalent career. And I feel like it's sort of an untapped market there as well. You know, why go on to QVC? Well, you can almost create your own infomercial through your followers if you have a good following at that point. So I feel like Barbara was really seeing the potential in him by knowing the amassing that he's gained in the past 3 years.
Yeah. So, you know, the Sharks are definitely intrigued. Kevin's already made an offer. Barbara's already made an offer. And then we got Robert coming in being, in the similar vein as Kevin, offering $100,000 for 20% of the combined business. So both Kevin and Robert are interested in combining the two with the hair product. And Barbara's just interested in the social media business. Aaron is a little bit hesitant about that. And he counters, can you guys do $300,000 for 10%? And Barbara's like, you know what? I'll do that. I'll give you half of that. $150,000 if you can find another person. Mark is unfortunately out. And then we get into Robert talking about sort of his vision for how to use Aaron. He's like, you know, I want to use your platform to move other products. And I want, you know, $100,000 for 10% of any products that you eventually put on this platform. And he seems to say that that's a bit tricky. I'm sure there's some like backstory, like contract stuff that they're not able to talk about here, because it does get a little bit vague about why he doesn't necessarily want to go in that direction.
Well, it's a little bit of a sponsorship thing, right? I feel like Aaron doesn't want to be the person that has to come onto a show and or make a video and say, okay, Robert is forcing me to pump out this sweater, even though I don't like it. I guess I have to do that. And again, I'm not sure with the endorsement deals with the other companies, how much he's forced to do that other stuff. But I think what he tried to vocalize, and again, this was one of these episodes where there was a lot of talking all at once, so it was tough to take notes on it. But what I believe was going on at the tail end of that deal was that Aaron felt like it's all about authenticity, and he doesn't want to necessarily shell out a product that he doesn't personally like just because now he's in this deal with Robert.
Right. And I think that was smart for him to say. So we go back to Barbara, and I think he goes back to Barbara and he's like, you know, if you're still willing to do the $100,000 for 10% of just the social media business, I'm in. And I think like Robert's still like struggling to like get a word in there, but you know, they've already made the deal. I mean, Robert's kind of left out of the cold, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, we saw that a couple weeks ago too, right? When they when somebody took a deal with Mark, I think, and Lori hadn't even said anything. So it's clear that, you know, etiquette is not necessarily king or queen in Shark Tank. And I'm assuming when Robert was trying to speak back to him that I don't think he was actually going to try to negotiate that much, because Aaron seemed to be against the general principles of what Robert was going for. But yeah, I mean, Aaron even talks about it in his post-Tank interview. You know, I thought I had a great line of products, but they wanted to just invest in me, so I'm fine selling myself. So I guess this is one of those cases of, like, now I can understand why they did end up calling him back, because he has basically made a career now and is almost a completely different person in terms of status than he was when he was first on. But yeah, I guess maybe Pete and Pedro was just sort of an unnecessary rider to the contract, if you will, to get in there.
Yeah, and I mean, this is an interesting deal, because essentially there is no product anymore. She invested in him. So I guess the $100,000 is going to be used to, I don't know, you know, advertising for his own personal YouTube platform, maybe like better cameras and better audio equipment. It's going to be interesting to see like how he develops after this deal, because she is pretty much investing in his YouTube channel, it sounds like, which I don't think has been done before in Shark Tank.
Yeah, I was talking about that before. So it'll be really interesting to see where it goes from there. You know, maybe he'll have Barbara on, maybe they'll be able to, I don't know, partner. We'll talk about partnering up with other products later on. Maybe she'll be able to do that with some of the other beauty products she has in line. So overall, a really, really interesting segment, not only because they ended up bringing someone back, which is such a rarity, but they ended up, you know, making an offer on something that wasn't even on the table to begin with.
Right. And I thought, you know, excellent deal for him, and good for him for getting in there for a second time. It's going to be really interesting to see where this goes.
Definitely. So let's talk about the interstitial here. So we do not have an update, but we do have a sort of season 7 in review.
Yes, kind of like a super cut of all the Shark Tank updates of the past season. A few of them I remember, like Shark Tank at the White House, which is very cool. Barack Obama giving Shark Tank a shout out.
Did you notice that neither one of the Canadian sharks were able to go to the White House?
I didn't notice that, but, you know, that makes a lot of sense, I guess. Let's be honest, the Canadians of Shark Tank are the real drivers of the show, are they not, Kevin O'Leary?
I definitely think they're the most reliable personalities on there, aside from Mark Cuban. But yeah, it was Mark, Barbara, and Damon. Then we get, like, as you said, little cuts of, like, Kevin married a couple, Damon has Chef Rocco Despirito, Barbara, we talked about the Cabo San Lucas on the podcast, we talked about Lori's trade show, Robert and the Shrek licensing with Happy Feet. And then we just get a general roundup of, like, some companies are very successful, others are really making a difference in the world. And that was pretty much it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, this is the season finale, and this was their opportunity to really drive home the meta message of Shark Tank, which is, you know, this program actually works. This program has a real life effect on entrepreneurship in the real world. And I think drilling home that message is essential for Shark Tank's future, because if, you know, Shark Tank is not able to make successful businesses, then the whole future of the series is in peril, essentially. So this is their way of continuing to hone in that message that, you know, we have a real life effect on American entrepreneurship.
And it might make for a happier ending than the one we actually got this episode.
Yes. So let's move into pitch number 2. Mike, do you want to describe this one or should I?
I'm going to attempt to describe it, and you're probably going to want to correct a lot of the things that I'm going to try to attempt to throw
in
here.
Can we just say that it's probably going to be so awkward, but let's just get into it.
All right. This is a product called PMS Bites by a woman by the name of Tanya Green. So she starts off with her pitch, and she's very demure and sad. And I'm thinking, like, okay, this woman is probably one of these people that just is a horrible salesperson and is not giving a good pitch. But no, she's attributing this to her PMS. And she described it has over 150 symptoms. You know, if you tabulate out how long PMS affects each person per month, it averages out to almost a third of a year. So PMS Bites are bite-sized snacks designed specifically for women on their period. And it combines herbs that typically treat usual symptoms of PMS. And I can imagine this must be an extremely awkward thing to pitch to a panel that has consisted 60% of men.
Exactly. And it's so good for her for getting up there and giving this presentation. And the only real cringeworthy moment, because I was like, someone's going to say something super awkward on this pitch. I think the only real cringeworthy moment was when Robert I think, turned to Lori and was like, you know, Lori's irritable. She's definitely going to need this. And I was like, oh, my God.
Yeah, that's that did not show well in Robert. I could totally imagine like Kevin saying that. But Kevin at least learned how to keep his mouth shut for the duration of this.
I was just holding my breath this entire time. Like, let's not make this cringeworthy, guys. Let's just get through this. But
yeah, exactly. We talked before in the past couple of weeks about the whole hypocrisy that exists sometimes with female entrepreneurs. This is definitely not helping that image.
Yeah. I mean, so going back to the actual like product and the pitch. So, you know, Tanya comes in asking for $50,000 for 20% of the company. And it's essentially a health food product that she has just marketed specifically kind of in a medicinal kind of way, but she doesn't obviously legally is able to sell this as a medicinal product, but she's like, you know, this can definitely help out with your PMS for women. But I was looking at this product and I was like, isn't this essentially Nature Box, but just very hyper marketed towards women on their periods? Like, she could have easily have made this, Nature Box being our hub sponsor. I don't know if you've tried any of them, but, you know, they make health food products and they sell it online. And she made the interesting decision to take a health food product and really narrow down the market to not just women, but specifically for women who experience PMS symptoms, which, you know, it happens to a lot of women, but, you know, not a lot of women experience them and not a lot of women seek out remedies to alleviate these symptoms. So she's really hypo-narrowed the market here, which is really interesting.
Yeah, I want to get your insight into that because I have not experienced
really,
these symptoms. I no, but I do legitimately want to find out because this, I mean, the market that she's appealing to are people who do suffer from PMS. I mean, and I don't want things to get too personal here, but I mean, what if you're someone that's undergoing that time, for lack of a better term, period, is, do you want to turn to something that would aid you, or would you just say like, okay, let me just tough it out for these 7 to 10 days?
I mean, from the experiences of women that I know, I feel like this is almost an accepted part of life, that, you know, this is just something that a lot of women just have to go through, unfortunately, you know, just the reality of being a woman. I know there's like one person that I know who I obviously won't name on this podcast who these symptoms are very, very severe. So they do search for more medicinal ways to deal with it. But I think that's a very tiny fraction of the female population. I think a lot of the symptoms, if you are a healthy woman, aren't terribly bad. But I can definitely see, you know, a lot of people want to, you know, alleviate any of the symptoms. Nobody ever wants to go, you know, through this every month. So it's interesting, but it's not, if I'm looking to alleviate my symptoms, you know, a health food product is not the first thing I'm going to think of. You know, the number one way a lot of women alleviate this is Tylenol or Advil. I'm not immediately thinking of, you know, what's a long-term health, vegan, gluten-free, herb-related product that can help me out. But you know what? There could be a market there.
I mean, what she was basically trying to sell this as is that it's like a healthy alternative to getting like a sugary snack. I mean, do you have those types of cravings when you're undergoing this time?
Some women do. I don't know what else to say about that. Some women do, you know, go for the sugary products. I think it's just a nature of how the symptoms affect each woman. And here's the thing, like, it's so individual. Like, it's, you know, the media kind of paints it as something that all women go through and all women experience it the same way. But, you know, it is a health issue that affects every single woman so differently. There are some women on one end of the spectrum who don't feel anything. And then, like I said, there's some women, I think 1 to 2% of women that severely, you know, experience bloating and cramping. So it's not a universal thing. And like I said, I think she could have done really well if she just marketed it as like a health product that can be used for PMS. But when you just have it labeled as PMS bites, the Sharks mentioned this, it's, you're just limiting your potential audience by so much.
Yeah, I mean, I think Lori even mentions like, hey, change the name, sell it, as you said, as a general healthy product, and then put on your website like, hey, this also works great to alleviate PMS symptoms. You know, draw them in with the food and then make them stay with the symptoms of it.
Right. And another thing that they talk about as a criticism of her product is she's not really driving it online. I think she has tried to get into some retail stores. I think she mentioned juice bars at some high-end gyms in Equinox and, you know, Massachusetts. And, you know, she hasn't really been having a lot of sales. She's only done about $13,000 for 2 months. She makes, I think, About 7,000 of them.
Jasmine, I believe that's $13,400.07.
Oh, yeah. Oh, you wrote down the exact number. Yeah, she was like,
She mentioned it. And I also liked Robert's little snipe of like, oh, can you be a little more specific?
Yeah. I mean, but like, you know, Mark's the one that really talks about how you should really be all over social media. This is something, if you want to keep with the PMS Bites name, it's something that can go viral, like, you know, get a few of the, you know, female oriented blogs writing about it. So he's like, you know, it's a strategic mistake to focus just on retail. And, you know, that's just the beginning of the many sort of problems with this product that they talk about, including the costs. I think they mentioned that she wholesales for about $450, meaning that she has to sell it for about $7, which is a little pricey for, I think, only three items that you end up getting. Yeah.
I think on the website it says like $15 for six. Shipping is free, but still, that's a lot. You know, you're paying $15 to basically take like six bites.
Yeah. So, you know, the price is just one of many problems with this, you know, price, the name, the sales strategy. So it was no surprise that absolutely none of the sharks gone on in this deal.
We did get interesting insight from Lori here, where she outlines in her mind three pieces of criteria that she uses to judge products, which are one, and something people need, something that people need and want. Two, it needs to have an affordable price. Three, needs to have a broad mass audience, which I feel like is a good like thesis statement of good Shark Tank products overall. But she believes that marketing as a PMS bite really loses a lot of your audience. So she's out. Robert says, hey, you know what? There's a lot of appeal in it as a health food item, but your sales are too small. You're out. Barbara makes a really interesting point, and I don't know if you picked this up as well about the pitch. She believes that she really needs a salesperson, and she uses the analogy of, I hear the words, but not the music. I mean, do you agree with Barbara here? Do you think Tanya had an overall pitchy pitch?
In terms of like her voice?
I guess in terms of Barbara just wasn't really wowed, it seems like, by her demeanor during this pitch.
Well, she did start off the pitch like pretending to be super low energy. And like, you know what they say, you only get one chance at a first impression. And for some reason, maybe she just didn't bounce back from that. Like if she was really sort of de-energized and then she really came back as energetic, I think it would have worked out. But I think Barbara has a point that she presented herself as de-energized, but then she didn't really like elevate her energy too much after that. So I think that was the point that Barbara was trying to make is, you know, I don't really see you as vigorously going out there. And I think, unfortunately, that little shtick she did at the beginning where she pretended to be really tired, unfortunately harmed her.
So Kevin calls Tanya the princess of small numbers instead of the queen of sales. So she's out. Mark, you talked about before, he's out because she made a big mistake by not focusing on social media and instead put all of her energy into retail. And he wants to be an investment, not tuition. So this will be the first of two deals that do not go through tonight.
Unfortunately, but you know, I was not surprised at all. There were just too many things, let alone like it's a little bit of a weirdly named product, low number of sales. There was just no way any of the sharks were getting in on this.
And look, in a good episode, we look at this and we'd be like, oh yeah, that was just bad overall. But this is tame compared to what we're going to talk about at the very end.
We're getting there. We've got one more pitch to go, or one more pitch before that final pitch, which is, pitch number three with Tomer Alpert, I believe, with his company and product called Felt. So we get at least one pitch of the night that kind of has a pre-taped video package. You want to just quickly run through that,
Mike? Yeah, so Tomer's from Colorado, so we get some nice, you know, picturesque. And, you know, we theorized this with the Hawaii package a couple weeks ago, that they're like, oh, great, we get to go to, like, beautiful mountainous city in Colorado. Let's do it. And he's talking about how, you know, he recently had a child, so now they're taking the baby on gondola rides and walking through playing with their dogs. But he has not taken home a paycheck in 4 years. And so this is definitely one of those stories, and we see it on Beyond the Tank as well, of, like, how much entrepreneurs really put their heart and soul and their wallets into these businesses to make them be successful.
How are you not able to take home a paycheck for 4 years is what I want to ask, because that's a long time to not have an income. But
I guess real estate is really cheap in Colorado.
I mean, there's probably some, like, you know, family must have given money, they might have taken debt, like that's the kind of stuff I'm interested in. Like, it's a big deal not to take home a paycheck for 4 years. And I think a lot of people shouldn't paintbrush the dark side of entrepreneurship, as I like to talk about. It's hard, and sometimes you got to take on debt, and that's not necessarily the best thing to do. But the story does have a happy ending if we run through the pitch real quickly.
Yeah, I've looked this up on other articles. I mean, he called this a veritable Hail Mary. I think this really... you know, sharks, the people on Shark Tank always come in and say like, oh yeah, this is our last shot, or this is the last thing we can do. It seems like in the case of Felt, this really was the last possible thing they could have done. If this deal didn't go through, they were out of the jobs and possibly homeless as well in the mountains.
Right. Not a bad place to be homeless. Well, I guess in the winter, we don't need to get into that.
So. Caves will sure serve as their homes. They'll be raised by wolves.
Right. Anyway, so they come into the Shark Tank with this company called Felt, which is essentially a very easy electronic way to be able to send greeting cards, thank you cards, by essentially using your tablet to download an electronic greeting card. And you can use a stylus pencil to be able to handwrite a message. And they sort of make the process of sending a card very easy for you, where they print it out with your sort of handwritten message. You can customize the cards with photos, and they ship off and mail the card for you. So you don't need to go out, you know, and buy stamps and, you know, go to the post office to be able to send a letter. So they come into the tank asking for $200,000 for 6% of the company.
Which, again, if we're following our rules here, always go 10 or above, though I think they end up going for 10. So, but, you know, six is a, you don't need to go in there with six. Overall, Jasmeet, what do you think about Felt? I don't know how often you send notes and letters to people. Is this something you would imagine yourself using down the line?
Yes, I would say that I loved this idea. It's something that I've like thought about vaguely of like, you know, I wish there was an easy way for me to store addresses and not have to like go out and buy stamps. I really love this idea. I'm someone who writes a lot of thank you cards. I love sending birthday cards and, you know, graduation cards. I think it's true what he was talking about in the pitch. There's just something very nice in this age of social media where it's, you know, people just write 5-line happy birthday messages on a Facebook post, that there's just something really nice to receive a card in the mail. It's another way to just really show how much you care about a person if you take that extra step beyond just like wishing someone happy birthday on Twitter or Facebook. And, you know, it is kind of a pain to like, you know, I don't even know where the nearest post office is where I live in San Francisco. So I haven't sent any cards recently. And it's, you know, if I had this app, I would imagine that it would just be a nice thing to do, a nice thing to have.
Yeah, I mean, I got married last year, so for the past couple of years, it's all been about handwriting invitations and cards and thank you notes to send out. Though I actually asked my wife about this, and she actually, and this just might be the more artsy person in her, she actually prefers like handwriting her own notes and sending them out. Like there's something more resounding in her to write them out rather than use a sort of app. The one point of contention I have with this app personally is that I just have really horrible handwriting. So I wouldn't want to actually handwrite a note. I would much prefer, like, let me put words into the system and they'll make it look nice.
Right. And like, if you don't have one of those electronic pens, I'm not quite sure what they're called. Styluses. Yeah. You end up doing them with your fingers. And if I had to write a message with my finger, it would look so like,
oh yeah. If you haven't, you know, signed enough electronic stuff yet with your fingers at, like, you know, when you're using your credit cards at stores these days, like that is so sloppy. I wouldn't want to try to handwrite a note on a tablet with my finger.
Right. You know, that's something I didn't think about immediately, but there's a little bit of a barrier that you kind of need a tablet and not necessarily your phone. And then you need a stylus. And then, like I said, the people who like to send cards, they need to be people who don't, like your wife, prefer to just do it with her own hands.
Yeah. So then I guess the question is, I mean, they're going to talk about how Tomer feels the two big markets that he needs to capitalize on are brides and professionals. Do you think this is too narrow of a market to work out?
No, I don't think so. I mean, like you mentioned, you know, you just said you spent the last 2 years being involved in this, whether it's, you know, invitations to bridal showers, invitations to the actual wedding, thank you cards, you know, and for professionals, there's a lot of like thank you cards that you send for people. You know, if you're a salesperson, I'm sure you send a lot of, you know, note cards out to be, you know, reminding them like, hey, you know, do business with us this Christmas. You know, Christmas cards is a big industry for professionals to just be able to send it to their clients and their vendors. I think there's a big market here, even if they've sort of divided it between brides and professionals. Those two markets are quite huge, I think.
And there is an interesting component here that Tomer brings up only briefly, but I feel like it could be a really big bankroll down the line of how some card companies want to use this as a platform to sell their own cards as well, which, I mean, if he can secure like a Hallmark partnership for them to release a couple of card templates for people to send out their cards through using Felt, I feel like that would be really, really key.
Would you see Hallmark as seeing this as a competitor, though? Like, wouldn't they want to try to do something like their own? I don't know if, like, Hallmark is necessarily going to partner with them, but it's an interesting idea that they can create a marketplace for independent note card designers to be able to sell their designs as sort of another revenue stream for them. I thought that was really intriguing.
Yeah, I realize maybe Hallmark might not be the best example, but I don't know. I mean, these greeting card companies, things are becoming more and more electronic. Paper is becoming more and more of a luxury than a necessity at this point. Who knows? Maybe Hallmark feels like, okay, we aren't getting enough traction as we used to with our cards. Let's try to make things as electronic as possible, and the app might be a way to do it.
Right. So, you know, going back to the pitch, Robert, I believe, is the first one to pipe up. And he's like, you know what? I think I see a lot of people doing this. There's nothing really proprietary about it. So he's out. They get into a little bit of discussion about customer acquisition. Tomer says they spend about $8 for customer acquisition, and the average bride will spend about $210 with them. Because I think at some point he says every bride sends out on average 75 thank you cards. It's, you know, I was getting a little bit, not annoyed, but it was just like, are brides really the ones who have to do all the thank you card work? Did you sign any of your own thank you cards, Mike?
I signed them. Okay. I didn't, again, since I have horrible handwriting, my wife wrote them all.
Yeah,
it's, you know, if they were like people that were closer to me than they were to her, I helped, like, I like dictated right. them, but no, I usually just put my old John Hancock.
I guess like bottom. I got a little bit miffed that it's a cultural thing that the woman in the marriage has to take on this responsibility, but that's a whole other discussion that's not related to what we're talking about.
I'm a little surprised that they, and maybe it's because Kevin does get on the honey fun bandwagon here in terms of brides, but he mentioned brides and professionals. I feel like they didn't talk about professionals whatsoever in the capacity that felt could be used for them.
Yeah, I guess maybe because he was able to give sort of the itemized numbers about how many cards a bride would typically send, that was something that was more immediately available for them to grab onto. And for Kevin, as he mentions, he says he has four companies in the wedding business, including Honey Funds, which is something that actually got mentioned on Beyond the Tank tonight, which we'll get to. And he's like, you know what? I have your brides, which sounds kind of like weirdly medieval-esque.
Yeah, it sounds like he's like, I don't know, it's like an arranged marriage or something. And he's like, or it's, you know, if we're talking about the beginning of Coming to America, when Eddie Murphy gets presented like all the line of women to choose.
Right. So it's a little bit weird, especially having Kevin say, it's like, I got your brides. But, you know, he's essentially what he's saying is, you know, I know exactly who your customers are and I can get your acquisition down to zero because I have them in my honey funds and my other wedding companies. But, you know, and he sounds like he's very interested, but he wants more than 6%. And he's like, you know what, I need a minimum of 10%. And he makes an offer of $225,000 for 10%. And everyone is blown away at the how reasonable this offer is.
And they said Kevin's heart grew three times that day.
Yeah, I mean, Mark pretty much says, you know, you'd be crazy to say no to that. He's out. Barbara's like, yeah, that's a pretty good deal. She's out. Lori's out. And everyone is pretty much saying, go with Kevin. Otherwise, you're crazy.
Yeah, they say, Lori, Barbara, and Mark all say, I'm going to make this easy for you. And Robert flat out says, like, I don't think he's ever made this good of a deal on the show before. Which, I mean, it is a really good deal. He only got, you know, 25K more for like 4% more. And it's really negligible at this point. He has the market, like, Tomer would be an absolute idiot to say no to this. And of course, even though there's a little bit, a moment of hesitation, he does say yes to it.
Yeah, I mean, 100% he was going to say yes, especially if he was as desperate as his video package said he was, like nearing homelessness and not receiving a paycheck in 4 years. This was his Hail Mary.
No, I have my dignity, Mr. O'Reilly. I will sleep outside. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I mean, so it was good. Like I said, I like this product. I think they can go in interesting directions with this, especially if they're able to like take the brides from Kevin's wedding companies and sort of funnel them into this product. I'm very intrigued about where this can go, and I really like the idea.
Yeah, I mean, they're going to talk in Beyond the Tank about action button this, action button that. I almost feel like, and Kevin comes up to him immediately at the end of the pitch and says, like, okay, we got to start doing this ASAP. I could totally imagine, I haven't gone on to Honey Fund, but I could totally imagine there'd be an option that, like, while you're setting this up, they can say, like, hey, why not help send out cards through Felt? So I feel like the integration was really there. This is definitely unlike, you know, Kevin's donut company with the frosting from a couple of weeks ago. Like, this definitely is a match made in heaven.
Right. That conversation after the deal is made was kind of funny to me because they're kind of like half whispering and Kevin's like, yeah, we got to get this up real fast. Got to get those brides.
Yeah, I don't know if we ever mentioned this, but I always, you know, we track the puns that are made during these pitches, but I always love the post-deal interaction as well, where the Sharks are supposed to get up and interact with them in some sort of way, because some of them are really nice hugs. But here, Kevin's like using the shaking of the hand as almost like an excuse to be like, okay, you work for me now, this is what we're doing.
Yeah, those like post-deal interactions, I always find them so awkward. Like, who goes for the hugs? Who goes for the handshakes? Who's crying? And you get to see how tall Kevin really is, which I don't think is very tall.
I remember when it was Mark and Chris Sacco with the whole Battle of the Billionaires, like they both got up and didn't even acknowledge each other. So there's always little things to have in there. Though my favorite part, even just of this post-deal interaction, might be the cockles of my heart were warmed when Tomer ended up calling his wife and they're both like in tears on the phone about how, you know, they really were in, it was a move out of desperation and it ended up paying off for them. So I'm really happy for them.
Right. I mean, they got their Hail Mary, but, you know, as we learned with Beyond the Tank, there's a lot of work that still needs to be done, but, you know, they got the boost they needed and I really wish them all the best.
Yeah, I mean, we can almost compare it to the Honey Fun stuff in I don't know how much this product would appeal outside of the wedding market. I know Mark found fault in that Tomer was like, okay, so it'll appeal to this one bride, but then this bride will have a birthday and have a baby shower. Mark really wasn't so sure if the customers would keep coming back after their wedding. And I might be inclined to agree with Mark here. I'm not entirely sure what proportion of sales will be for people sending out a bunch of random non-wedding or professional affiliated notes.
Yeah, I guess I would tend to agree. But, you know, if they're able to create this partnership with Honey Fun, they at least have a guaranteed market there. And hopefully they can just build from there.
All right, Jasmeet, let's get to the last pitch of the night. The last pitch of Shark Tank Season 7. Let's lock this up, if you will.
All right. So we've got Pavlok with Manish Sethi. Do you want to describe what this is or shall I?
All right, so this will be a lot easier to describe than the PMS bites, probably. It's a wearable. It looks much like a Fitbit or an iWatch that helps curb bad habit by using aversive therapy, a la Pavlov's dog, which is what the product name is a parody or a pun on. It will administer a short electric, he calls it a zap, but it's a shock to the person to help curb their bad habits, psychologically speaking.
Right. So he comes in asking for $500,000 for 3.14%.
Oh my God.
A very specific number. And this is a very interesting pitch. He says he's someone, Manish, who suffers with severe ADD, and he hired someone to sit down next to him while he worked, who would slap him every time he logged onto Facebook, which I was just like, I mean, everyone kind of has a Facebook problem, but like, does it ever come to the point where you need to hire someone to slap you?
Yeah, so I feel like we need to break down this product itself before we go into this pitch and the ensuing chaos that follows. I mean, so this is basically the more severe equivalent of wearing a rubber band on your wrist and snapping it every time you have an inclination to smoke or to, you know, go onto Facebook or to do something else. As much as Manish may want to dress it down and give it clinical studies and give it a nice sleek look, you are still giving someone an electric shock. And for that reason, I'm personally out from its inception.
I mean, it's not giving someone an electric shock. You're giving yourself an electric shock, I guess, is what essentially the product is. And yeah, like, who would ever do that to them? I guess if he's the kind of guy that would hire someone to slap him, maybe for him, it's not a big logic leap to create a product that would shock you. But I think for the vast majority of people, they don't want to be administering harm onto themselves, as even as low of a shock it could be.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I know that obviously bad habits are tough to kick sometimes, but if we're comparing this and no phone, I'd rather go with the no phone approach than the let me hurt myself to avoid my bad habits.
I think at a certain point he gives all the sharks a band to wear and he's like shocking them, which is really funny.
That was my favorite part, because at first they're like, okay, this isn't so bad. It's like, oh yeah, this is mild, let me turn it up. And you just see them all start swearing their heads off, except for Lori. Lori, Miss Ice Queen, is like, oh, I don't feel anything.
Right.
And it, of course, like, she would totally, I think she's totally the type of person that would like I don't know, she cut her own leg off and not complain about it. She is just that stone faced when it comes to this type of stuff.
Right. So Manish gets into the science of this, and he's pretty much saying, you know, there are 21 clinical trials that support aversion therapy for bad habits. And the camera just keeps cutting to Mark. And it's so obvious that he is just hating this so much. And I'm like, OK, I can't wait to get to the Mark shutdown. That's going to eventually happen in this pitch.
Yeah, Mark is, this might be the angriest I've ever seen Mark on Shark Tank. And this includes 3 weeks ago when he saw him get into a yelling match with Chris Sacca, as we just mentioned. This guy, Mark, thinks this man is probably the biggest con artist he's ever seen on the show.
Yeah, he's calling him crazy. He's calling a con artist. He's calling him a liar. I have to say, I think this is pretty much the angriest I've seen Mark on the show as well. We move over to Robert, and Robert asks a very legitimate question, in my opinion. You know, if you have the discipline to buzz yourself to prevent yourself from, you know, engaging with your bad habit, why can't you translate that discipline to just not having the bad habit in the first place? He's like, you really need someone else to be buzzing you off of, you know, smoking a cigarette or eating a bag of chips. Because, like, if you can stop yourself to buzz yourself before you eat that bag of chips, can't you just not eat the bag of chips?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you're basically copying a scene from, like, season one of The Simpsons when they're all shocking each other.
I was thinking the exact same thing. I wasn't sure if you remember that episode or not.
Oh, of course. Yes, it's one of the classic highlights of The Simpsons. I mean, Manish, also, we can talk about his pitch in general. I mean, I don't want to generalize people who have severe ADD, but I feel like that behavior type might not be conducive to something like the Shark Tank, because it's going to get to a point when all the sharks are shouting all over each other at him, and he is clearly out of his element. He really cannot handle all the words that are being hurled at him.
Right. I think at one point he's like, you guys are giving me my ADD again, which I felt.
Just shock yourself, Manish. Start shocking yourself. Yeah.
You know, it's a tough environment because you got Mark just immediately yelling all over the place that you're a con artist, don't believe in the science. And Mark even starts yelling at the other sharks who are trying to, I think, legitimately give this guy a chance to explain himself, being like, you guys are idiots for believing in this. How can you be so gullible? Don't be so stupid to listen to this, Robert.
Yeah, which, again, like, Mark might be a little rough around the edges at this part, but he is kind of right. I mean, Manish, when he has his quote-unquote evidence book, but this is showing trials that he hasn't done. I'm looking at the website now. They do have, you know, 23 testimonial videos, but who knows? Does that range from people that were, like, hired to do this to, you know, friends and family that, you know, said, yeah, I'll put in a couple of good words? I mean, Manish isn't exactly supporting his product too much here. He's saying, I think Mark asks him, like, hey, what happens when it doesn't work? And Manish just simply says, well, it only works when you don't want it to work. And yeah. It's like, you need, like, substantial facts, buddy. And he gives up this kind of BS story about how, like, well, someone did it when they didn't want to eat cookies, and the flavors actually changed when they used it for a week. And everyone's like, okay, that's a bit of a step too far.
Yeah. So, you know, none of the sharks are really buying into this. I think essentially what they're criticizing is that he just downloaded a bunch of studies about aversion therapy. Yeah. Off like
he basically did like a research paper and put the bibliography in a packet.
But, you know, his sales are pretty decent. He says he's done about $800,000. Three quarters of that were pre-orders. A quarter of that were prototypes. He sells this for $200 for one device. But really, you know, they don't really get into the numbers because there's just this shouting match led by Mark about how this is so stupid. Lori eventually gets in there being like, you know, she has her tagline, I know when it's a hero product. And she's like, this is a nowhere Nero.
Yeah, that was bad. That was, I think Robert De Niro might work better than nowhere Nero in terms of a hook there. Lori, little bit of a bad miss there. You could have just said zero.
Yeah. Then we got Barbara coming in and she's like, you know what? Your presentation's exhausting and complicated. She's out. You know, Robert brings up the elephant in the room, which is like, this is a $60 million valuation, just on pre-orders. So he's out. And Mark, pretty much, you know, I guess this is the end of his sort of tirade where he's like, you know, the one thing that kills tech products is hyperbole. If you had just said this is something that could, you know, be one of many things that could help you out with bad habits, this could have been viable. But if you're, you know, presenting these scientific studies and say this is the way to break bad habits, he's like, you're going to be crushed because eventually you're going to have to execute on that. And he doesn't think he can. So Mark goes out.
Yeah, it's interesting how much Mark thinks that Manish is like a snake oil salesman at this point, or a shock oil salesman, and that he's like, you're just trying to like dress something up for, and says that something will work, and then I'll buy the product for $200, and then you'll run away, you know, and skip town at the end of the day.
Right. And then we move on to Mr. Wonderful, who always just like puts in these little tidbits from his life, and you're like, wow, Kevin's like done all sorts of things. And the tidbit we get out of this episode was that he had an undergraduate degree in psychology. And he believes this technology does work. He believes in the truth of aversion therapy, but he does say that the valuation is crazy. And he puts together a very interesting offer, which is, you know, $500,000 for the debt. He still wants the 3.14% equity, but you got to pay back that $500,000 in 24 months or 2 years at 7.5%. And he's like, you know what, if even one third of your projections are correct, this is a great deal for you.
Well, you would think that, right? But Manish kind of has his own agenda here. And this is, I mean, we were talking about, this probably was like, what, an 8 on the severity scale. Here's where it jumps up to a 10 or even an 11, where Manish says, like, basically, thanks, but no thanks. He says, and, you know, so people have said that before. We even talked about that with Inchbug, where they say, or other people where they say, you know, I got this offer, but I really can't take it. But Manish did not take Kevin's offer simply because he does not like Kevin. He says that you're too focused on the money. I can't work with you. I feel like you would be a bad investor in my company.
I'm trying to think, like, has there ever been someone in the Shark Tank who pretty much flat out says, I don't want to do this because it's you? I mean, it's definitely insinuated in some of the turndowns of offers previously. Like, you can kind of tell, it's like, oh, this person doesn't really want to work with Robert or work with Damon. But I think this is the first time that someone's like, the deal is good, it's you that's the problem. And how insulting is that?
It's extremely insulting. And look, again, I can understand that, you know, you probably, I'm assuming everyone who walks into Shark Tank has at least one or two sharks that they specifically want to work with. And I'm assuming Mark was probably the big one for Manish. And Manish definitely made a horrible estimation on that part, because Mark was the first one to decry against it. But I don't know. You got any port in a storm here, Manish? You gotta, if you really need this much money and you really have this much of a valuation, I feel like you kind of have to take the deal here.
Right. So, you know, as he's turning down Kevin, Mark jumps in again, being like, you know, you didn't even want to make a deal here. You're here for the exposure, which is something that Mark does accuse people of a lot of the times. And I mean, do you think he just kind of came into the Shark Tank just for the exposure?
I don't know. I mean, because we talked about the no phone. I feel like that was one of the very first things we talked about on this podcast. And we had asked the question about, like, is this legitimate, or do you think this was much more of a joking product? And I would say that was more of a joking product than this was. But that being said, I mean, what does he need the money for? I don't know if they asked that question, but what, does he have to scale? Does he have to invest in more technology? I know he said he was working on things like the Pavlok alarm clock, that is a specific alarm clock app that sets, you know, if you sleep past your alarm, it will zap you awake, which sounds frightening. but I don't know exactly what he was planning to do with the money. So I'm almost tempted to say that he just went on for the exposure.
Right. I mean, well, the problem with the pitch was that they got so into Mark's anger and the lack of clinical trials that they didn't really dig into the numbers too much and maybe what he would have done with the money. So that's a little bit unfortunate. But yeah, I mean, like, I'm not 100% convinced that he was just there for the exposure. I think something, he just hit Mark's bad button and it just kind of all derailed from there, unfortunately. But you know, he kind of kept his composure. I don't know how I would have felt if I had all these sharks yelling at me. Then again, I wouldn't have said flat out, I don't want to deal the deal because I hate you, Kevin. So
exactly, like, you, as much as you could kind of pity Manish at this point, he almost dug his own grave at the very last second by saying, like, oh yeah, you're giving me a deal for a product that nobody else likes. No thanks, I'm good. And, you know, Mr. Wonderful, they talk about, I think Chris Sacca talks about how they, like, almost always are told to never swear on Shark Tank, but they keep in Mr. Wonderful saying, Manish, you're an asshole, get the F out of here.
And an additional F you, if you weren't clear about how Kevin feels.
And then calls him a gold digger afterwards.
So on that note, that is the last pitch of this next season. We end it with Kevin's F-bomb of season 7.
Yeah, so let's talk about this. First off, I do want to give a quick update because I see on the Pavlok website, there is a tab called Saw Us on Shark Tank, and it has a video of Manish talking about what's gone on with the product since Shark Tank. Now, it's interesting. First off, we find out that this segment specifically filmed in September of 2015. So I guess I'm assuming that they did kind of film on a staggered schedule, and this probably filmed a little bit later in the run, but right when the season started. He says that, you know, he's worked on a couple of different things, the alarm clock being one of them. But interestingly enough, he starts off the video by saying, like, hey, if you clicked on this video, you've seen us on Shark Tank. Now, I haven't seen the segment yet, so I don't know how it's been edited. And all I could do is, like, shake my head, like, oh, buddy, you do not even know. You don't even know how much you have been raked in the mud and dragged under the bus in every which way.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I guess, did he not think that he would be edited so badly is my question. And that links to like a lack of self-awareness, perhaps. Maybe that has something to do with his ADD. I don't know. Like, how could he have, like, Kevin is telling you to get the F out. Did he think he was going to be edited in some sort of hero light?
I don't know. Maybe he thought that, like, oh, they must do this to products all the time and it just gets edited out. But I don't know. Maybe he got a little too many slaps in the face and all the sense got knocked out of him. He does point out that there is another video that he posted of, well, here's a video with the shark that you didn't see. We didn't note that Damon was off this week. I'm assuming he was raking in the benefits of the two questionable products he invested in last week. He certainly went out with a bang, but I mean, it doesn't even show Damon using the product. It was like him and Damon on a beach on an island somewhere. Damon's just wearing the Pavlok and they're asking just a bunch of questions about bad habits. Damon isn't even using the product. He isn't even endorsing it. They just happen to see it on his wrist. So if he's not even getting a ringing endorsement from the shark who isn't there, I feel like it's a no-go.
Wait, how did Pavlok get involved with Damon if Damon wasn't there?
I have no idea. Maybe they reached out to him. Maybe he like came to the company afterwards and said, like, okay, can I at least reach out to Damon and see what he has to say? I don't know how this was. There a contact sheet that Manish stole at this point? I'm not entirely sure, but this whole Saw Us on Shark Tank tab on the website just really interests me.
So yeah, that's the last pitch of the season. And well, I mean, what do you think of this overall product? Like, even if it's not something for you, do you think it could potentially be successful?
No. I don't think so.
Flat no.
Yeah, I'm giving it a hard no. I know some people there are some sadomasochists out there in the world, but I really doubt that the vast majority of people would say, let me buy a product that, granted, well, it might be working for a better cause and, you know, getting over my habits and addictions. Something that harms yourself. It just doesn't work, in my opinion.
Yeah. And I think, like, you know, he made references that this is really training the reptilian aspect of your brain. I don't think people want to really see themselves as sort of like in a base level view like that. Everyone wants to be seen as, you know, significant, sophisticated human beings. I think that's a little bit weird. No one wants to, like,
people don't want to see themselves as rhesus monkeys.
Exactly. Yeah. So I mean, do you want to just get into our rankings, I guess, because I think we all know where we're kind of going with Pavlok.
Well, there was one more thing I want to mention, and you even talked about this at the beginning of the podcast. What did you think about the choice to end this episode and the entire season on this pitch? It was very climactic. And that you have sharks screaming over each other and everything. And, you know, Mr. Wonderful telling someone to get the F out of the shark tank. But it definitely ended on a much more dour note than, you know, what I would have maybe suggested was, let's switch this and Felt. Felt was arguably one of the most heartwarming stories we've seen on Shark Tank in the past few weeks. This was much more of a clown show. If you switch them, I feel like you end on a much more uplifting note for that and the show itself.
Yeah, I mean, and that's typically the narrative of each episode. They usually have the most successful deal of the night end up as the last pitch because, you know, you want to feel like your time watching the show was worth it. You know, you change someone's life. Someone's business is going to get off the ground. You turn off the TV at 10 p.m. You feel good about yourself. Shark Tank is a success story. That's kind of the narrative that I think they push, and they do that with the updates. They do that with Beyond the Tank. And this is just so drastically different in how it ends with swearing, Mark yelling, a guy that they're calling a con artist, a deal that's not being made. It was a very drastic switching of the tone, not only to just end any episode, but to end the actual season. I'm curious as to why they did it. Obviously, we don't have the answers, but maybe they're feeling like, hey, are we getting a little too touchy-feely with this show? Should we start amping up the drama and show, like, these sharks have teeth?
Yeah, which I would not approve of. I don't. There's an unfair image of reality TV to the public in general as like something that's sort of trashy nowadays. And I do not want to besmirch other ABC franchises, but I don't want this to turn into something like the Bachelor franchise or like the Challenge franchise, where it's kind of become almost like a joke of itself. Actually, Andy Denhart of Reality Blurred released an article right before the episode aired about like how he would fix Shark Tank. And the recommendation he made was to actually start swapping out Mr. Wonderful, because I don't know if anyone noticed, but Mr. Wonderful and Mark are the only two who never take an episode off. But I don't know, if anything, this episode might have secured Kevin and Mark's places in the Shark Tank, just because they were the two real big instigators behind this TV moment.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, I know that's a phrase you guys laugh about, but at the end of the day, this is a TV show. And I think the producers have every right and they have a desire to increase the drama wherever that drama is. And maybe, I don't know if this is really a signal that they're going to be changing the direction of the show in terms of tone wise. I don't think so. I think they just kind of wanted to end on a bang. And I think Shark Tank season 8 is still going to continue with its sort of fluffy air of, you know, making the American dream come true with just punches of these dramatic moments. I think they just kind of wanted to end on a bang. They wanted to end the season, possibly just creating a ripple effect to keep some conversation going over the summer. I don't think it's any indication that it's going to turn into something overly dramatic and negative, like, you know, maybe some other reality shows are.
The most dramatic pitch ever.
I just think they just wanted to end on a bang. I don't think the tone of the show is going to change drastically.
I guess we'll see. I mean, I have a feeling that it might even be trending that direction in the past 7 seasons. Let's remember when we talked about the very first pitch on Shark Tank that the show came out in a time of the recession. So I'm assuming they were a lot more hopeful of like, oh, look what these businesses can do. Now things have become a lot more realistic. But I don't know. It's a slippery slope when you say like, oh, actually, it's almost like, you know, speaking towards addiction, like you get a first taste of some sort of drug. You're like, oh, actually, I sort of like the shame. Let's promote the shame more and more.
Right. So definitely this is something I guess we can try in season 8 of whether, you know, the sharks were given notes and are applying these notes of being more aggressive. So we'll see what happens next season.
Definitely. But first, let's go back to our power rankings here. So we are going to rank, in our opinion, the 4 pitches that we saw, which are, once again, Pete and Pedro, though it ends up kind of being Alpha M, PMS Bites, Felt, and Pavlok. So Jasmeet, what is your power ranking for the season 7 finale of Shark Tank?
So number one, by far for me, is going to have to be Felt. It's the one I like the product. I like the people. I think the deal was extremely reasonable. I think Kevin actually is really interested in sort of moving this forward. It was Kevin the one that invested in it. Yeah. And, you know, I feel really good about it. That was number one by far for me. Number two and number three, I guess number two, I'll go with Aaron Marino. Again, I don't really have a lot of experience in sort of, you know, investing in a YouTube star and what that would look like in terms of converting that into money. But, you know, I like Barbara. I think anything Barbara gets behind is really great. And yeah, and I think his sort of social media platform can bring a lot of success for whatever he ends up deciding to do. I would actually put Pavlok as number three. I mean, just because like he's able to have made a lot of pre-sale orders, and even if this product is not for me or you, I do see some sort of target market of masochists who'll just buy something like this for themselves. And I think I read somewhere that, you know, appearing on Shark Tank is the equivalent of like an $8 million ad buy. I think a lot of people are going to watch this, especially considering
it didn't work for Aaron that first time.
I think a lot of people are going to watch this and see the drama behind this. It's going to definitely have a ripple effect. I think some people will be very interested in using this product. He seemed like someone who was just unfazed by what happened, so I don't think he's going to be rattled too much. I think he's just going to keep plugging away at this. And then number four, I would just go with PMS Bites, just because the name, the low sales number. And yeah.
So I would probably flip-flop both of those sets. I might have Aaron inch out Felt at this point, just because I do feel like Felt might be a little handcuffed by, oh, it's really going to appeal to brides and possibly business people. And I, again, we'll have to see, but I'm not entirely sure how much it can branch out into the markets of, you know, common greeting cards. It's going to do great in terms of invitations and wedding affiliated things. But the question of, is this product really going to stick with someone in multiple occasions is still yet to be determined. Whereas I feel like there is a wide berth of potential here in investing with a YouTuber like Aaron. And granted, you know, while he did walk out having an investment for a completely different product than what he walked in with, I do feel like the YouTube potential is so wide out there. And the fact that he does already have a loyal following, it'll be interesting to see how Barbara is able to utilize him and vice versa moving forward. And I'll have to say, you know, while PMS Bites again really narrowed its field, I feel like if they just take Lori's steps and they market themselves as a health food that happens to mitigate, you know, PMS symptoms, or even if they take Mark's advice and say, all right, let's just make this a viral thing, you know, you could totally see a BuzzFeed article reading like, oh, these snacks are known to help your PMS. You know, I could totally see it selling well there. Whereas Pavlok, I don't like the idea. I don't like the guy. I don't like the presentation. I feel like three strikes and you're out in that regard.
Yeah, I mean, I think depending on the kind of person you are, these all were very interesting pitches that you can kind of order them in different ways. So it's going to be really interesting to see if Beyond the Tank does come back, to see if any of these get featured and how well they do after the tank.
It'd be really interesting to see Kevin visit Pavlok the next season.
I don't think that's going to happen, but yeah.
The first time fists have been thrown on Beyond the Tank.
Well, speaking of Beyond the Tank, we can talk about its season finale as well. Beyond the Tank aired its last episode of the season. And do you want to talk a little bit about the potential future of Beyond the Tank before we kind of dig into what was covered?
Yeah, so we got an article tweeted to us over the course of the week, and there's been a few articles that have been going around saying, you know, Beyond the Tank, obviously there's a lot of news with the upfronts that came out in the past week. Beyond the Tank was not listed on the fall schedule, which is not the end of the world. It did come in as a mid-season last year as well, but I think the big question on everyone's mind is, will Beyond the Tank make a return appearance? And it seemed like the executives kind of gave an answer of like, hey, we're willing to bring it back, we just need to figure out how, which does not harken too well for the show. I mean, if we're going to give a quick pseudo obituary to it, I think the conceit of the show is good. I mean, when you build as a huge alumni pool as you do, having four pitches an episode for seven seasons, it's cool to check back in. It's cool to experience some typical entrepreneurial problems that one might experience. But I think your problems are A, segments are extended too long, B, the really hokiness that comes out of this show. I mean, this is like, some people say that the pre-tape packages are the worst part of Shark Tank, and that's essentially taking the pre-tape packages and making them 15-minute segments on a show. So that can be a problem. And C, you know, they try to put it out on its own on Tuesday nights, and I feel like it works best when it's either right before or right after Shark Tank.
Yeah, I mean, I've mentioned this many times in our discussions of Beyond the Tank. It was not my favorite thing to watch. It is not my favorite thing to watch, just because, like, the points you mentioned, I just feel like the segments are very stretched out. The climax points and the problem that each entrepreneur faces feels very staged. The conversations are very staged. And it never really appealed to me in the way that Shark Tank did, because Shark Tank, you know, as Chris Sacca mentioned, it's live, not like live as in, you know, TV live, but it's, you know, unscripted in the sense of you don't know what's going to happen. You don't know what the sharks are going to say. You don't know what's going to happen during the pitches. You don't know if deals are going to go down. So there's just that real life element of drama to the Shark Tank that just completely gets lost in Beyond the Tank. And I think, and I've mentioned this before, one of the big reasons why Shark Tank is so successful, I think, is because of the inter-shark interaction, just kind of like how the voice judges, you know, kind of battle it out as well. And you're completely taking that element out in Beyond the Tank, where you maybe only see one or two sharks per episode and they're not interacting with each other. They're, you know, stepping in as sort of more of a mentor role. And, you know, some of them kind of get tough, like we'll see Kevin get tough every now and then, but it's not as fun as seeing, like, you know, Kevin and Mark go at it, or, you know, Mark and another shark go at it. So, you know, if this is the last that we see of Beyond the Tank, I'm not going to be overly sad. And, but yeah, we'll see if it comes back.
Yeah, and I mean, there are no real... It's weird because there are legitimate stakes to the ideas that are being presented on Beyond the Tank, but it doesn't feel like there are legitimate stakes to the show itself. You know, I think we talked about the one with the... when the company went with the water slide of like, okay, we have to know that this deal is going to go through because otherwise the show wouldn't go through with it. You know, as much as we just talked about, oh, is this a turning point for Shark Tank to become a little meaner? I feel like Beyond the Tank is not going to necessarily show, hey, look, let's watch this business fail on camera. Rather, they'll do a sort of testimonial like they did with that one company and show like, okay, this is how a business kind of falls apart. So all three of our companies remain relatively unscathed, which is the vast majority of what happens on Beyond the Tank.
Right. So we can quickly run through. We got three segments tonight. Sometimes we get four, but tonight is three.
Well, I mean, Honey Fun took up the length of like two segments. Actually, yeah. both Corduroy's and Pork Barrel actually took up a pretty short time. Honey Fun took up, I think, like 25 minutes, including commercials of airtime.
And I don't know about you, but I was like, okay, let's get to the point. And it was kind of interesting. Like, it kind of took some twists and turns, so we can quickly run through it. So Honey Fun, as we mentioned, is this crowdfunding website for honeymoons. And it aired on season 6 of Shark Tank, led by Sarah Margolis, I believe.
Sarah and Josh Margolis. So Sarah is definitely speaking on behalf of the company.
Yeah. So, you know, they said that they've raised $200 million for couples. But I guess they see a limited market in just honeymoons. So they decided to start a second business called Plum Fund, which is just kind of the same as Kickstarter or whatever crowdfunding website of choice you've experienced.
So that's my problem. And this was actually one of the pitches that I've seen previously on season 6. And I actually really liked the idea at first, especially as like someone who got married. I greatly appreciate the gifts that I got. But, you know, couples that are getting married always say the best gift is cash, just because you can really do anything you want with it. And a lot of it did go to our honeymoon. And this is a great idea for you to basically say, OK, let me put my gift to use and contribute to a honeymoon. But as you just said, they want to try to focus on things like baby showers, birthdays, emergency funds. What's the difference between this and things like Indiegogo and GoFundMe that specify in like, hey, if you want to raise money, come to this website? You're basically like going from an extremely successful narrow pool to a big wide pool where you can barely swim.
I mean, yeah, there is no difference, but I can see why it's very appealing. Like, I don't have the hard numbers in front of me, but Kickstarter and Indiegogo are extremely successful because I think their business model relies on taking a cut of whatever ends up being fundraised, whether that be 1% or 2%.
Well, Kickstarter is if you succeed in your goal to get a certain percent, otherwise you get nothing. Good day, sir. Indiegogo is, okay, you can raise however much you want, even if you don't reach your goal, but we get a certain percentage of it.
Right. So, you know, they didn't get into the details of like where they sort of fall in, like, you know, does your entire fundraising thing go away if you don't reach your goal, or like what percentage they take? But this is such a competitive market, and I can see why that they seem to be struggling with it. You know, so they go into talking about the struggles that they're facing. So we should
I mention that they first talk about these problems to an extremely staged office presentation where people just sit, probably extras, people from central casting,
right,
just sit around and just nod every time it cuts to them.
Right. I mean, it's just funny because like meetings like this don't ever really happen. As someone who works at a startup right now, it's like, okay, you know, and this is how we make money, and this is what has happened, and this is, you know, an iPad presentation of like circles.
Yeah, it's the equivalent of like when a sitcom episode starts and they're like, okay, family, as you all know, Aunt Marjorie's coming over to stay for the weekend. Like, it felt very expository.
And again, like a reason why Beyond the Tank just feels so fake, because, you know, these meetings aren't legitimately happening. They had to like come into the room and light it and go over what they're going to talk about and the facial reactions that everyone needs to be giving during the segment. But essentially what they're saying is Plum Fun isn't profitable. And they want to use the profits, or I think they are using the profits from Honey Fun to support Plum Fund.
And yeah, and their alternative was, I think, was to basically, they usually, you know, have Honey Fund and then they try to have like premium usership in Plum Fund. And essentially, what they want to do is offer the Honey Fund people premium usership in Plum Fund right off the bat. So you're basically eliminating your income from these upgrades and membership to basically just bring people to your other website, which I think Sarah will say later on is a huge cut, about 60% of their revenue overall, which Kevin is aghast about.
Yeah, I mean, like, that's a little bit troubling. I would also be very concerned about this business play that they're doing. So, you know, Kevin comes in, he's just like, what are you guys doing taking, you know, your number one revenue from Honey Fund and cutting the upgrades, thinking that you're going to transfer some customers and, you know, build up that transaction revenue over here. And then we kind of, I don't know if this is the best transition, but we end up with Arianna Huffington ending up in the show. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, where did that come from?
No, it's like, you know what?
I know someone, because I thought like, okay, Kevin's going to have somebody to meet with. And it turns out that, oh yeah, you know the Huffington Post? Yeah, I'm going to have you meet with Arianna Huffington so you can basically advertise on their website.
It was so strange. I was like, okay, this is what you're going to do. I don't like it. But you know who you should meet? Arianna Huffington. Let's go to New York to her office. It was just the strangest transition ever.
Yeah, though I do like Kevin before bringing up the Huffington. He does say, you know, here's a marketing strategy. You could make this a quote unquote one time offer. That way, if it succeeds, you keep going with it. If it fails, you can just say, okay, that was one and done. So that way it doesn't feel like a huge initiative that you failed on. But yeah, then he drops the Huff hammer in a way that he says, okay, let's go to Sarah. You're coming with me across the country to New York. And we're going to meet with Arianna Huffington.
Right. So the next segment ends up them being in New York, meeting up with Arianna Huffington. This is the most completely random comment I'm probably going to have on this podcast, but did you notice the weird double cheek kissing that was happening in the segment?
Yes. Yes. I noticed it too. That was in my notes too, about how Kevin seemed to kiss Sarah on both of her cheeks, which feels oddly European.
Right. I was just like, I've never seen this happen before, but they've got that kind of relationship going on. And then he's also kissing Arianna Huffington on the cheeks. And it was just like, what is going on? It's reminding me of, yes, Survivor with all the kissing happening.
Exactly. It was basically or you know, Cody Califori from Big Brother 16. So, but basically, and this is a really long, drawn out meeting. And essentially what it comes down to is Arianna says, oh, okay, great. I'll post success stories on the Huffington Post, and I'll also post, you know, little action buttons for relief funds. And they also take a rather dark turn when they say, like, okay, well, we can also offer divorce services through our website as well.
So, like, essentially crowdfunding your divorce in a company whose main sort of revenue comes from honeymoons, which was a little bit awkward.
Well, I guess that's called diversifying your market, right?
Right. And, like, you know, they can keep track of these brides and grooms going on their honeymoons and figure out which ones are going to get divorced, I guess, and then offer them
exactly. Harp on the ones that are most likely to, and then, like, follow up with an email like, oh, I heard about your recent divorce. Why not, you know, get a crowdsource for alimony?
Oh, God. It was an interesting segment. It went off in all different weird tangents with the divorce and Arianna Huffington, and they're in New York, and then all the cheek kissing. It was just weird.
Definitely. So as we said, that takes up the vast majority of, or a plurality of time during the episode. So let's go to the middle segment, which I think takes all of like 7 minutes. It's Corduroys, which is a season four product that is bean bags that essentially convert into beds. They made a deal with Lori, who Lori actually seems to get a controlling share in the company. She said 58% for $200,000. But it seems like Byron has done really, really well for himself. He's appeared on QVC once a month for about the first year and a half. And he got so successful that he moved out of his usual studio shed and actually bought a huge studio space. Now the problem is, as always on Shark Tank, they want to go retail, but because this is such a big product, it's a bean bag, they need to figure out how to package it in a way where you can get multiple products on the shelf.
Right. So the segment is pretty much Lori meeting him in his like warehouse closet, showing them different variations of how they can package this to get this on the retail floor. They have some discussion about the pillow pods retailing for $149. And she's like, you know what? I think you should make it $100. And that was just like a very easy, like, okay, we're just going to cut this by a third in terms of pricing.
Yeah, and there was also a thing about, like, there was a really bad product where I guess he released blocks that convert, where if you fold them out, you can, like, make a bed, but it takes, like, 6 blocks to form a king-size bed, and that's just too much. I know personally I would not want to buy 6 of these blocks for the chance of making, you know, what's akin to an air mattress.
Right, and the segment, which was pretty quick, wraps up with some discussion about how, you know, they have all these appearances on QVC, but it takes a while for them to actually receive the money. But lo and behold, Lori has a check to give, and she like gives him this like rumpled check out of her pocket, I guess. I was like,
what do I have here? Yeah, I guess this.
I was like, if you're going to give a $60,000 check, which I think was the amount, like at least not have it be crumpled like it was just at the bottom of your purse, like you're gonna give it
Yeah, though I do like the solution that they came up with to the problem of, like, again, these things are too big, but they also offer them in multiple colors, so how do you do this without having to fill an whole aisle with them? And Lori comes up with the idea of, you know, put one in a box and then hang the colored covers next to it, so that way people can like pick out the color they want, essentially, which I think is was a good way to solve that problem. But yeah, the whole like $56,000 relief fund essentially for this company while they're waiting seemed like a little bit of a last minute 11th hour type of thing.
Yeah, they're like, okay, we need something to wrap up this segment. Lori, write a check.
Yeah, she was probably writing it like in the limo, like on the back of somebody, which is why it's so rumpled up.
Yeah, exactly. So going into the last segment of Beyond the Tank, possibly the last segment ever for Beyond the Tank, we have Pork Barrel Barbecue, which is going all the way back to season one. So we talked about how a lot of Beyond the Tank segments are from season six, but this is a throwback to season one and a very non-HD flashback. I don't know if you noticed that.
Well, usually with these SD clips, they'll like put the sides in black, or they'll like blur the sides to make it look a little more professional. This they kept in its full widescreen glory, but it was extremely blurry.
So, you know, we go back to the original pitch, which I think was $50,000 for 40%, which is a huge deal for Barbara. And essentially, it's this barbecue sauce company. And like, I'm like, just even fatigued just to go through it, because like, Beyond the Tank, I can't get into it.
I mean, basically what it is that their new product was bacon jerky, which actually made me really excited. I'm usually not a fan of the dehydrated meats, but the idea of bacon jerky sounds appealing. The problem is, since they previously released like spice rubs and barbecue sauce, they don't really need to get any sort of permission from the USDA, since it doesn't really deal with, you know, expiring food products. But since this one deals with meat, their co-packager has to get approval from that. So the problem is the co-packager is not living up to their deal. They said it would take 2 weeks to get approval when it actually took like 3 months. So they finally went in to reach out to them. And that's when the co-packagers happened to say, oh, yeah, we just got an email this morning that we got approval. But then they basically say, OK, now we have to get a move on here. But I don't know. I was checking their website. While the bacon jerky is not touted as the main piece, it is still on their store. So I guess everything turned out fine.
How convenient that just that morning when the Shark Tank crew was coming in to film them, they got the email. So cue eye roll.
Well, I mean, it's also a thing of like, OK, the Shark Tank people Shark Tank people are coming in. Okay, let's just tell them we don't have the email. Wait a minute, there are cameras coming. Okay, let's just reach out to the we have to get the USDA now on the phone. We have to get the approval done right now.
And that closes out the last episode of Beyond the Tank for the season. Do you have any sort of thoughts overall about the segments we saw?
Yeah, I mean, again, I do feel like Honey Fund, while they had a lot more going to it than the other two, I do feel like, again, it was drawn out very long. I felt like basically like an entire half hour show could have been made about the events of Honey Fun. But the other two were fine. As we predicted, everything turned out right in the end, which, you know, again, the show is heartwarming, albeit a little predictable.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I got through watching these Beyond the Tank episodes, but it's not my favorite thing to watch. I think Shark Tank is really where it is. And I think, you know, if we just get reduced to just the updates in the main Shark Tank episode, I think that fulfills the promise of Beyond the Tank. But it just, Beyond the Tank as like a full 1 hour episode, I think was just a bit too much for me.
All right, Jesmy, that will do it for Beyond the Tank, possibly forever, but also Shark Tank season 7. Do you have any thoughts about the Shark Tank we've covered thus far and any hopes for season 8?
I think, you know, we did a pretty good job. I think, you know, coming in on the tail end of season 7 and covering this for the first time for RHAP, there's definitely a lot of things we could probably tweak, which I'm sure me and you can talk about in the off season. But I think we did a fairly good job covering what the last six episodes of season 7, long overdue for it to be discussed in RHAP, I think. And hopefully you guys like what we've been doing here, and we'd love to come back for season 8.
Yeah, and I mean, I always love podcasting about shows, because it lets me approach shows that I've watched rather leisurely in the past with a more critical eye. So I really enjoyed just getting to sit down and talk with you about this stuff. It also, you know, since these are products that are out in the world, it's always been fun to talk about whether we would use them, how it relates to our personal lives, which I feel like you can't really talk about with other shows. So I've been very grateful for the opportunity to come on and talk to you about this. Next season should be interesting, especially if Chris Sacca is involved in a more recurring capacity than he was previously. I really enjoyed the rather incendiary time he had on the show during the episode we covered. So it'll be nice to see him come back. It'll be interesting to see what other guest sharks might appear as well. Are we done with Ashton Kutcher? Will Jeff Foxworthy return? Who knows? I'm sure more information will be released for season 8. But that's going to do it here for season 7. Thank you guys, as always, for listening. We've really enjoyed the feedback that we've gotten over the course of these few podcasts we've done at the tail end of season 7. Jasmeet, thank you so much for coming on. It's been a delight getting to meet with you and talk with you, and I can't wait to do it more in the coming months.
It's definitely been a pleasure. You know, me and you actually have not met in person, so hopefully one day down the line we will be on the same coast where we can actually say hello to each other in person. But honestly,
yeah, well, we'll fly you out to New York to meet with Arianna Huffington, and on the way you can stop by my apartment.
Exactly. Apparently anyone can get a meeting with her. But no, it's been a pleasure. You know, this is my first time podcasting ever. So thank you for everyone who's been patient with me in terms of getting my sound issues in order and like learning how to podcast and, you know, speak eloquently here. And hopefully I'll just continue to get better. And I'm excited to come back. Do we have a hashtag for this episode?
Yeah, I have a few options. I have hashtag Pete and Pedro Pixar, hashtag Huffhammer. I'm trying to think about a couple of other ones.
What about Hangry Shark?
I like Hangry Shark. I think that's a good one to describe the attitude, especially towards Mark at the end of this episode. So that being said, Shark Tank will premiere season 8 in the fall. We might be doing some off-season content in the during the summer months, just because there's a lot of Shark Tank for us to talk about in the months in the time that we weren't podcasting about this, and we want to make sure we jump upon that time that we might have off. So no promises as of yet, but make sure if you aren't yet subscribed to Reality TV Rehab Ups on iTunes. Go to robhasawebsite.com/rehapups, R-H-A-P-U-P-S. There you can subscribe to not only Shark Tank coverage, but also coverage of The Challenge, which just started, The Bachelorette, which is just about to start up in a couple days from the time we're recording this. The Reality TV where Happy Hour is always going, especially as we get into Big Brother 18. So there's going to be a lot of great stuff for you to check out over the summer. But that's going to do it for this podcast and possibly for this season. So again, hashtag Hangry Shark. You can reach out to us on Twitter. I'm at a Mike Bloom type. Jasmeet is at Jasmeet Sidhu, S-I-D-H-U. We'd love to hear from you guys, anything and everything about Shark Tank. Thank you guys, as always, for listening. Thank you, Jasmeet. For now, the tank is closed.